Welcome to the 63rd episode of the Frank Online Marketing Show, where we examine how companies can market themselves more effectively in the digital era. My name is Tema Frank, and I'm your host. Today's guest is Dr. Niraj Dawar, who's a professor of marketing at the Richard Ivey School of Business. He's also consulted on three continents to companies like Cadbury, Microsoft, and L'Oreal, as well as to startups. And he's recently written a very interesting book called Tilt, and I came across him reading a Harvard Business Review article that he had written, When Marketing is Strategy. And I'd highly recommend that you have a look at both the book and the article. But if you don't have time for that, stay tuned for this podcast, because we talk quite a bit about the concepts that are in the book. Essentially, what he's arguing is that we've got to shift from a product focus to a consumer focus. And I'll let him go into more detail for you and chat with you briefly at the end.
My name is Niraj Dawar, and I'm a professor of marketing at the Ivey Business School in Canada. My background is that I have a PhD in marketing from Penn State. I've worked on three different continents as a professor of marketing, but also as a consultant to companies, including Cadbury's, Microsoft, L'Oreal, Asahi Glass, and companies like that. Around the world, as well as startups. I wrote the book Tilt, and it was published in November, and the article that you mentioned, which appeared in the Harvard Business Review, was an extension of the ideas in the book.
Okay, so the book Tilt and the article When Marketing is Strategy, you talk in the article in the book about upstream activities versus downstream activities. Can you talk a little bit about what you mean by those terms?
Yes. So if you array the activities of a company, the value creation activities of a company, all the way from sourcing of raw materials, production, logistics, and even new product development and R&D, and then all the way down to customer interactions, including activities that relate to customer acquisition, customer satisfaction, customer's retention, understanding customer preferences and serving those preferences. So those are two sets of activities. The upstream activities are those related to putting the product together, the means of production, the factories, the logistics, the supply chains, the sourcing, and the R&D. And the downstream activities are those that are customer-facing or customer interaction activities, and those relate to acquisition, satisfaction, and retention of customers.
Okay, and you're arguing that the downstream activities are becoming much more important from a competitive perspective than the upstream activities, whereas traditionally we're focused more on the upstream activities. Is that correct?
That's right. If I could just elaborate on the idea there, for 250 years since the Industrial Revolution, we have had an emphasis on the upstream activities, our sources of competitive advantage, our costs, and the value that customers buy and pay for have all been attributed to the upstream activities, to the factories. So as a means of competitive advantage, we built larger and larger factories. We benefited from economies of scale. And as a result, the customers saw value in buying what we were producing. And the consequence of that has been that the strategy of a company and the entire strategy discourse is strongly infused with ideas of maximizing the efficiency of the factory, maximizing the efficiency of the infrastructure that has been built in the upstream, pushing more product through, and trying to, so there's a focus on volume, which is reflected in things like our obsession with market share, for example, which is a volume-based measure. And so what I'm saying is that what has happened in the last 20 to 25 years is that the factories have been streamlined, and even outsourced, and you can buy on the open market. Businesses can buy the benefits of scale on the open market. They can go to contractors that have built the large factories who are happy to supply product to branded goods manufacturers. So you can buy, and what that does is that it commoditizes the upstream. and that the three things that have happened, the three shifts that have occurred, is that our primary costs, because we've streamlined and outsourced the upstream, our primary costs now are in customer acquisition, customer retention, and customer satisfaction activities. So there's been that tilt. Also that customers see value and pay significant premiums for the activities that we conduct downstream. So one example is that a customer could buy a can of Coca-Cola as part of a 12-pack or a 24-pack in a supermarket, and the average price they would pay would be about 25 cents a can. The same consumer on a hot day in a park might drop $2 into a vending machine. Mm-hmm. And that difference, you know, the 700% price premium that they're paying for the can of Coke is accounted for by downstream activities, not a better can of Coca-Cola, but a can of Coca-Cola delivered at the point of thirst in a single serve, chilled. And so those are the kinds of activities that the customer is willing to pay a premium for.
So distribution then, is that considered a downstream activity? Distribution systems?
Distribution is the enabling activity here. But what you're really delivering is the value to the customer of a product that is customized to their particular circumstances, to the particular circumstances of being out on a hot day and looking for a drink in a single serve chilled format.
Right. So being there when and where and how they needed it.
Exactly. Okay. And so you know, we've seen costs have shifted from the upstream to the downstream. Value has shifted from the upstream to the downstream. And as a result, sources of competitive advantage also today are increasingly coming from customer interaction activities, understanding customers, knowing customers, and making things easier for customers in the downstream.
Yes. Now, you talked about customers not always necessarily being able to state what their preferences are, and you quoted the Steve Jobs example with the iPad about not doing focus group research because when it's something so radically new, customers can't articulate that that's what they want necessarily. Can you elaborate a little bit more on that?
Sure. I think we're increasingly living in a world today where we don't need to ask consumers what they want, and often
that sounds like heresy.
we don't need to ask them because for a couple of reasons. One, often they don't know, and the answer that they will give you is based on that, you know, customers don't really know what they want, and they can't articulate it. They can't tell you what they want, and often they don't know what's possible. But also, I think we don't need to ask them because we have so much information about their actual preferences that from their past behavior, from their purchases, from their browsing behavior, from the information that they leave behind in terms of cookies and crumbs as they travel through the internet, we know so much about consumers that we don't need to ask them what they want. Their actual behavioral preferences are much better indicators of what they want than their stated preferences.
So you've just wiped out the marketing research industry. So essentially, though, you're saying that...
I think, you know, on the marketing research industry, I think the smarter market research firms have over the last few years really shifted to understanding the information and insights that are coming out of incidental information. And by incidental information, I mean information that consumers leave behind, mm-hmm. While traveling through the information universe that we live in, the phone calls they make, the credit cards they use, the purchases that they make, their loyalty cards, their internet behavior, all of that adds up to a very, very rich picture of the consumer. And the smarter market research firms have understood that and have really refocused to try and draw insights from that data.
So basically it becomes about the whole big data thing and learning how to use that data more effectively rather than...
Very yeah. So, yes. In fact, there's two full chapters in Tilt devoted to looking at big data, not in terms of the technical aspects of an analysis, but really asking the question, what are the strategic things that we can and should do with big data?
Yes, that's an interesting point. You also talked in your research about being able to essentially define the marketplace the way you want it. Can you elaborate a little bit about that, about your ability to create your own market space?
Mm-hmm. So one way to think about it is you can actually define two critical components of that. One is you can define the dimensions or the criteria along which consumers purchase,
yep.
The criteria that they consider important in their purchases. And the second is that you can define who your competitors are by positioning yourself in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of criteria, I think you can define or you can help define and influence which criteria consumers consider important in a particular category through your advertising, through building up the important. A simple example is that Volvo doesn't sell a better car. Volvo tries to convince consumers that safety should be an important criterion in their purchase. And once safety is an important criterion in their purchase, consumers gravitate towards Volvos.
Mm-hmm.
So the task of a brand manager, the task of a company selling a product should not be to demonstrate that their product is better, but rather to demonstrate why certain criteria should matter more to customers than others.
That's very interesting. So it's not necessarily about being better, it's about positioning yourself in a unique way.
Exactly. And it's about positioning yourself on a dimension that you can own.
Right.
It's about making sure that the customer understands the importance of the criteria that you're trying to occupy. And those criteria, for leading brands that occupy sort of the center space in a product category, that the criterion is often performance. It does a better job.
Mm-hmm.
So Nike is about performance. Tide is about performance. Intel is about performance.
Yeah, really, in those examples like Nike or Tide, it's not that their products are actually necessarily any better. It is all about how they've positioned it.
Exactly. And so the brand occupies the central dimension of, this product does a better job. And so second and third entrants into that product category will need to find their own dimensions. Otherwise, they get, they end up being perceived as Me Too brands.
Well, and it's interesting because you made the comment that in some ways it can be an advantage to be a later entrant. And, it made me think back to my first career was working in the Canadian Bankers Association. And one of the things that we noticed at that time was that Scotiabank always chose a strategy of letting the others experiment with the new stuff, and then we see what works and we'll do it too. So how does that later entrant thing play out in today's world?
Yes. The fast followers are a pretty interesting breed. They tend to let pioneers make all the mistakes. They learn vicariously from those mistakes and are able to solve the problems that the first entrant encountered. But I also believe that it's not about being first to the market. Most firms that were first to the market may or may not be around a few years later. It's the second and third entrants that occupied. They weren't necessarily first to the market or first with the technology. They were first to occupy a dimension or a criterion of purchase in the consumer's mind.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to solve consumer problems in terms of reducing their risk or reducing their costs of accessing the product, of using the product.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to then occupy that dimension over a period of time. An example is we don't use the 6 Degrees social network. We use Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And 6 Degrees was around a few years before Facebook.
Yeah, or even MySpace.
Yes, exactly. We don't use Chuck's diapers. We use Pampers
mm-hmm.
diapers. And so the examples are fairly abundant of companies that were first to Mindspace enduring, whereas companies that were first with the technology don't necessarily dominate their industries a few years later.
That hits really close to home, because in 2001, I started a company called Web Mystery Shoppers, which was essentially large sample size remote usability testing of websites. And, you know, ours was basically tied for first company in the world to be doing that. Uh-huh. And yet, it really wasn't until a decade later that companies really started making a go of it. And, you know, ultimately I reached a point where my software needed an overhaul at the same time as the U.S. economy was in recession. I couldn't afford to do it at that time. Well, now there are other suppliers that do that kind of stuff. So, so they got the idea, but did it at a better timing. And once I'd done the education, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there are not necessarily benefits to being too early.
Yeah. Now, you also, I thought, made an excellent point, which is that if you're trying to avoid being compared with other brands, then you should structure your marketing and distribution and packaging in ways that avoid the familiar cues that customers have. Can you elaborate a bit on that?
Yeah. And, you know, you can play that both ways. You can highlight the similarities with other products in order to be perceived as a substitute for them. For example, when memory cards for digital photography first came out, they did everything possible to be seen as a substitute for film. And so they had to provide the consumer with familiar cues, such as placing light sensitivity indicators on the packaging. They made them yellow and gold, just like Kodak. Nice. They placed them in the supermarkets next to the film. Or you could go the other way. You know, if you're trying to avoid competition with certain types of products, then you want to be placed away from them. And so, you know, if you're Brita filters, for example, you don't necessarily want to be compared with other filters. You want to be compared, let's say, with bottled water. And because you come out looking fairly good on a per liter basis, if you're compared with bottled water, for the same benefit, which is clean water at the end of it.
But let's just talk about that for a minute, though, because Brita filters, yes, initially, because they were one of the market leaders, could position themselves versus bottled water. But now there are so many other filter type companies. How do they maintain their position then as the dominant one, as the better one?
I mean, think of it this way. If I ask you, who's the fastest runner on the planet, you'll tell me?
Usain Bolt.
Right. And who's the second? Exactly. And so you know, Brita Filters occupies the Usain Bolt position in the category.
Okay.
And it's so they occupy the shelf space. And retailers are unwilling to give similar types of shelf space or to competitors because they've already got this novel item in the in the bottled water category, in the bottled water aisle. And if they start to turn it into a filter aisle, it's no longer a bottled water aisle. And so, so that's one advantage that Brita Filters occupies. But the second advantage is the one that we just talked about, which is just like there is sort of a limitation on shelf space, there's also a limitation on mind space. Mm-hmm. And consumers are willing to allocate mind space to the first brand in that category, but not to the second.
So then does that not seem to contradict your point about it's not necessarily best to be first?
It's not necessarily good to be first with the technology or even first to the market, but you have to be first to the consumer's mind space.
So you're saying people who come in to compete against the Brita filter now need to find some other dimension other than just
copying
what Brita is.
For example, a dimension might be, you know, if you look at the bottled water aisle, you have the Brita filters, and on a per liter basis, Brita filters are much more economical, and yet consumers are buying bottled water. So why are some consumers still buying bottled water? And the answer is because of portability.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you could offer a Brita filter in a portable sports bottle format, then you would have a new criterion of purchase that you could get consumers interested in.
Personally, I find the whole bottled water thing mystifying in countries like Canada, where we have good water.
We have excellent water. In fact, the water that comes out of the tap is tested every 2 hours, and it's fairly fresh in that sense. Whereas bottled water is water that has been sitting in a plastic bottle for 6 weeks. And is on the, has been on the shelf, has been exposed to ultraviolets, where the plastics have leached into the water, and we pay a 2,000% price premium for it relative to, what we could do is open the tap and filter the water if we wanted to.
I know, I find that totally bizarre. And I've heard from dentists too that, the kids who have problems now are the ones who are drinking bottled water instead of tap water.
Fluoride.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. You also talked about how reducing costs and risk for customers is central to any downstream tilt. And yet what I'm seeing is that a lot of companies, as you said at the beginning of your work, is they're still very much focused on that industrial age model. How do you get a company to change its perspective?
So companies, the first question they need to ask is, well, what I try and do is I lay out questions and checklists for managers at the end of every chapter in the book. Mm-hmm. And the starting point is to understand what business you're in. Mm-hmm. And it's an old question, but the answer, I think, needs to be really thought out. And often it's an indicator of where managerial attention is focused. Mm-hmm. The answers tend to be we're in the business of either the product that they're selling or in terms of the production facilities. For example, we're a bank. Or if you're a software company, then we're a software company. We're in the business of selling software. We sell risk management software for enterprises, for example. That's the standard answer. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is we need to start to look at business and understand our business through the lens of the customer. And, we've paid a lot of lip service to customer centricity, mm-hmm. but when you look at organizations, when you look at companies, they're still organized very much around their products.
Yes.
We have product divisions, we have product managers, yeah. We have the product managers have product budgets. They have product P&Ls, they have product targets, they need product volume. Salespeople are incentivized mm-hmm. on the basis of product commissions. It's all product-based.
Yeah.
We're still not looking at the customer as the center of activity.
Instead of having product managers, let's say, then should we really be having persona managers, like somebody, different people in charge of different customer segments?
Exactly. So segment managers, for example. And then the question that we would start to ask if we did that, if we started to place the customer at the center of the company, we would no longer be asking how much more of this stuff can we move. Mm-hmm. We would be asking what else do our customers want.
Right.
So we'd be moving from an economies of scale type of question to an economies of scope type of question.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the big transformation that occurs within a company.
That is fascinating. And it makes so much sense. And yet it's certainly a very tough one for traditional organizational structures to come to terms with.
It is absolutely wrenching. I've seen organizations try to do it, and it is very difficult.
So what do you think are some of the success factors to making it work if you're trying to change an organization in that way?
I think the success factors are that companies recognize the need for change, and they recognize that there are opportunities in defining their business with the customer at the center of the business, mm-hmm. that those opportunities, what often happens in terms of the difficulty of getting people to switch from a product focus to a customer focus is that the benefits of customer centricity play out in the long
That's
term.
That's what I was about to ask you next, yep.
Whereas all the costs related to the transformation play out in the short term.
Right.
And so it's so difficult to get people to recognize the benefits of the transformation in the long term when all of the costs and to them are occurring in the short term.
And also the potential rewards, because stock markets are totally focused on short term.
They are focused on quarter by quarter. Right. And so making this transformation from product to customers can take 6 months. It can take 2 years. And, the stockholders often do not have the patience for that kind of transformation.
So do you think there's hope in getting stockholders to change their perspective of getting this message through to the market so that publicly traded companies really can make the changes?
You know, companies do make long-term investments. They make long-term investments. They've always made long-term investments in the upstream. Mm-hmm. The trick is to get them to see the downstream not as, downstream costs, not as expenditures, but as investments.
Yes, absolutely. And that becomes difficult because it's a lot harder to calculate and predict the return on that investment than the investment exactly. in a factory or a new piece of equipment.
That's right.
One of the things that also interests me, and you and I are both based in Canada, and what you're talking about doing here requires a lot of innovation. And traditionally, we've seen Canadian companies are often kind of reluctant to truly innovate in the ways that you're talking about. Do you see in your work much of a difference there between Canadian companies versus, say, American companies?
I think there's, it depends more. There's more variability across industries than there is across geographies.
Okay.
You find innovative companies in some industries. You find greater receptivity to the message in certain industries. And there are three types of companies that truly are receptive to the message or for whom the message has value.
Mm-hmm.
And the first type of company are companies that have historically been very product-obsessed.
Yep.
And there are companies like that in the technology industry. There are companies like that in the pharmaceutical industry. There are companies that are very product obsessed because the product has traditionally been their source of value, mm-hmm. their source of competitive advantage.
Right.
Then there's companies that operate in commodity spaces where their product is no different than their competitor's product.
Mm-hmm.
And these are companies that are in bulk oil and chemicals and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And here there's tremendous value in finding ways of differentiating from your competition that are not product-based.
Mm-hmm.
And the third type of company third type of industry in which this is valuable is where the companies are looking to move up the value curve. In other words, to be able to increase their margins by increasing the complexity of their marketing, by understanding segments better, by understanding the market better, by uncovering new opportunities and new uses for the product, by understanding how customers use the product, for example. So those are three types of companies or three types of industries in which the message really does resonate.
Yeah. I've noticed that there are more and more companies now that are creating a position of chief customer experience officer. Do you think that in most companies they're just kind of jumping on a bandwagon but not really getting the message, even in those companies?
Yeah. So I think the customer is probably too important to leave to one manager, even if that manager has a C-level title.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you start to think in terms of how much our companies are structured around products, even the organization structures, the measures, the accounting, the incentives, everything is product-based.
Mm-hmm.
And when you start to think of what it would take to transform such an organization to placing the customer at the center, you realize that one C-level manager championing this is not going to be able to do it. It has to be, it has to be the entire C-level team recognizing that the center of gravity of the firm needs to shift.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you'd like to comment on that I haven't asked about?
No, I think you've covered a lot of ground.
Great.
I think ultimately the transformation is happening across industries, and I think companies need to ask themselves, what will be the trigger? Will it be external forces where they see competitors moving downstream and they haven't yet moved downstream? Or will they, you know, will the impetus be internal, where companies recognize that they can be first movers to move downstream and capture opportunities there?
Yeah. Well, it's a very exciting time. And I, as I said, when I first contacted you, I'm very excited by what you've written. It fits in very much with the research that I'm doing for my next book, which is looking at really very much the same thing. It's looking at what do you need to change internally to deliver on that external marketing promise. And my conclusions are...
And I look forward to reading it.
I will certainly make sure you get a copy. In fact, I'd probably love wonderful. To get you to read it and give some feedback as I'm working on it, if you're willing. That would be...
I'd be delighted.
Well, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. It was a very interesting conversation. Thanks.
Thank you.
We've talked a lot on this show about the importance of finding a niche. But what's interesting about what Dr. Dawar had to say was that he's saying not just finding a niche, but even with your product, finding a competitive positioning that you can own, finding some new dimension that perhaps nobody else is promoting that product on that can really be your place. And as with finding anything that's going to succeed in the market, you really need to understand customers and what they're looking for and what benefits they want. As a marketing researcher, I must say it was a little scary to hear him say that, you know, he doesn't think we need to do market research asking people their opinions anymore, that we've got enough data out there to answer all the questions. Not sure I completely agree, but certainly it is true that often you can be misled with things like focus groups because people don't necessarily know what they want, as Steve Jobs so vividly proved by creating entire new classes of products like iPads, tablet computers. The other thing that I found interesting and perhaps also a little disturbing for the large numbers of companies that are now racing to set up chief customer officers is his perspective that that's not enough. That to really transform your company in the way it needs to be transformed now, your entire C-suite has to become chief customer officers. So interesting words there, and certainly there's no question that these chief customer experience officers are in for a tough battle in a lot of companies, unless they start really twisting their thinking around to look at life from a true customer perspective instead of a product perspective. That's all for this week. I look forward to your feedback and comments. Please, as always, you can telephone me at 1-866-544-9262 with your feedback. You can also send me an email, Tema, T-E-M as in mother, A, at frankonlinemarketing.com. And please visit the site and check out the other podcasts and blog articles. And I'd really urge you as well to sign up for the newsletter. I must confess, I've been kind of bad about sending it out over the last couple of years. I average maybe once a month, but I'm really trying to make it much more regular now. But never fear, I have no intention of bombarding you daily like so many in this field do. So that's all for now. Have a wonderful weekend, and I will chat with you next week. Bye.